usually occur at very small scales, but there are also some phenomena like superfluidity or superconductivity that are visible on scales that are close, that are macroscopic. And so obviously for this, we need many body physics. So the question is now, why do you want to do many body physics with quantum gases, so with dilute systems? You need to go to much, much lower temperatures to observe quantum mechanics in dilute systems. So it's a very high price to pay. But it also has tremendous advantages that have something to do with correlations between particles. So in a liquid, particles, so it's very dense, so particles collide very often, and they're also very strongly correlated with each other. But in a dilute system, particles move almost freely most of the time. And if they do collide, then it's very unlikely to have three particles in one place. So collisions are basically two-body collisions. And this leads to the particles being almost uncorrelated. So you can write down really simple basic models that describe your system, and you can study the effect that's interesting for you in a very clean and controlled setup. So this is the advantage. And basically, to break it down to three main points, ultra-cold quantum gases are A, very simple. So they provide a direct realization of very basic models in quantum mechanics. They're also extremely tunable, meaning that they can be very easily and with great precision controlled in an experimental setup. So you have control over basically everything, interaction, strength, temperature, external potential, and even the dimension of the system. And finally, they're very versatile, meaning that they can be a very good description for a variety of real-world systems. And so today, I will be talking about Fermi gases, which are systems of fermions. So for instance, you can imagine this be a description for electrons inside a metal, or neutron matter, and even maybe a quark-gluon plasma in the core of a neutron star. But mainly, I'm thinking about an atomic gas. So a gas of potassium, say, or lithium atoms that can be created and studied in an experiment. And you see here a picture of one of the first fermionic condensates that was measured by the Gila group in Boulder, Colorado. So as I mentioned, we have, of course, to go to very low temperatures to see quantum mechanics. But now with fermions, we have a difficulty. So due to Pauli principle, if we have identical fermions, then scattering is strongly inhibited. So we have no S-wave scattering, and basically at low energies, we will only have an ideal gas. So if we want to study interactions, we need to take fermions of two species. And when I say two species, well, we could take two different elements, two different isotopes, but mostly, so in this talk, I'll be only talking about the same elements, so equal masses, but you can put the fermions into two different spin states, which I will call spin up and spin down. So if you do have two different spin states, then interactions, of course, become important. And since we are at low energies, the first, the leading order of the interaction is sufficient. So it's sufficient to consider S-wave scattering. S-wave scattering, as you maybe remember from some scattering theory, is described by a single parameter called the scattering length. So because of the diluteness of the gas, the exact shape of the interatomic potential doesn't really matter. And so all what matters is this one scattering length that tells you about the interactions between the particles. I will only be talking about attractive interactions for the rest of this talk, but the picture looks very different depending on what value and also what sign of the scattering length you have. So this is depicted in this little cartoon here in terms of the inverse scattering length, 1 over A. So on this side, where the scattering length is very small but negative, you have very weakly bound fermions in momentum space. So you get Cooper pairs at of two fermions at opposite ends of the Fermi sphere that are very weakly bound. And this regime can be very well understood in terms of the BCS theory. So this weakly interacting regime is fairly well known. Now, the other extreme here is the very small but positive scattering length. And this corresponds to really, really strong attraction between the fermions. So in fact, attraction is so strong that you get strongly bound states or molecules. And these, in turn, because they consist of two fermions, will be bosonic. So effectively, on this side, it's sufficient to consider bosons, and this is why this is often called the BEC regime. So you just can write down a theory for non or weakly interacting bosons, and this is also fairly well understood. And so what I'll be talking about today is in the middle between the two. So this is the regime of a divergent scattering length. And this is also called the unitary Fermi gas. So it's a very, very strongly interacting gas, but fermions are the relevant degrees of freedom. And a good way, I think, of visualizing it is maybe starting off from the BEC side and imagining you're making the interactions weaker and weaker, so your molecules kind of get pulled apart and get larger until sort of their scale becomes comparable with the distance between the particles. So you no longer have bosonic degrees of freedom, but you still have very strong interactions. So why are we interested in this particular case? Well, first of all, it's a very nice example where our system is still dilute in the sense that the distance between the particles is very large compared to the range of the potential, but it's also strongly interacting because the divergent scattering length is obviously much larger also than the interparticle distance. Also, because the scattering length diverges, it drops out of all of our equations, and so we're basically left with no scale associated with interactions. So we have a universal behavior. And in fact, our system only depends on two parameters, the temperature and the density. So we can write down all our quantities as universal functions of some combinations of these parameters. So for a theorist, that's a very nice and beautiful system. Another really exciting point is that, so I probably forgot to mention that across all values of the scattering length, the interacting Fermi gas has a transition to superfluidity. But the properties of this transition vary, of course, depending on the scattering length. And so for the strongly interacting Fermi gas, this transition temperature is really, really high. So if you look at this table, I'm comparing it with two other systems, neutron star and a high TC superconductor. And if you look at the values in Kelvin, it's maybe not so impressive, because obviously the neutron star has a really high temperature, millions of Kelvin, high TC superconductor can be around 100 Kelvin, while the atomic Fermi gas is something of the order of nano Kelvin. But as a theorist, I don't want to see the temperature in Kelvin, I want to compare it to a temperature scale that's typical for the system, and that's the Fermi temperature. So in units of Fermi temperature, this TC is much, much higher than for the other two systems. So it's of order of a tenth of the Fermi temperature. And so the hope is that by studying the unitary Fermi gas, we can get some deeper understanding of how high TC superfluidity and high TC superconductivity work. Finally, of course, we have experimental data that we can compare with, which is also really exciting. Now, in terms of the methods, we have strong interactions, so we cannot do perturbation theory. And in fact, there isn't any exact theory that describes the unitary Fermi gas. So we could do some approximations, but these would be uncontrolled. So this means that we don't really have an estimate over whether an approximation is good or not, and we have to kind of rely on our intuition. So this is why numerical methods have found really wide application, and they have provided some very good results. And so this talk today, so I will be telling you something of different thermodynamic properties of the unitary Fermi gas at or near the critical point. And the method that I'll be using is a numerical method called determinant diagrammatic Monte Carlo. And it's based on this reference by Borovsky Prokofiev system of Montroya. So the algorithm that I'll be using is very, very similar that the one these guys have invented. And so now I'd like to tell you a little bit about the model and the methods that I'm using. I try to sort of briefly summarize many different technical parts of the project, so just in case maybe one of you is working on something that involves similar methods. And if you have questions, please feel free to interrupt and to ask. The model that I'm using is the simplest lattice model for two-particle scattering, the Fermi-Hubbard model. Here is the Hamiltonian with a kinetic term and an interaction term. So we have just contact interaction between spin-up and spin-down fermions. It's all non-relativistic fermions. And the interaction is characterized by coupling constant U, which is negative for attraction. And we can tune this U so that this model actually describes the unitary regime. Then, because we're interested in the thermodynamics, we work in the grand canonical ensemble. And we put the whole thing on a finite three-dimensional cubic lattice with periodic boundary conditions. So the dispersion relation here is just the cosine dispersion relation, which is the discrete Fourier transform of the kinetic operator. And in the end, of course, so I'm interested in the homogeneous system. So I will need to take the continuum limit to get us back to the physical system. And this happens by extrapolating to zero density. So the intuition is that when we dilute the system, then the lattice matters less and less. So eventually we recover the continuum limit. For the finite temperature formalism, so we can write down the partition function. And just with Wick's theorem, we can expand it in terms of Feynman diagrams. So you remember we had just contact interaction, so four-point vertex. So we have these vertices that all carry a coupling constant. And the lines are just free finite temperature Green's functions for spin up and spin down. And so we have, of course, different ways of connecting them. So we get lots of different topologies and different diagrams. But there's a caveat. Because we're dealing with fermions, due to the anti-commutation relation, we also get minus signs associated with the loops. So some of these diagrams, namely the ones that have an odd number of loops, will carry a minus sign. And this is, of course, very bad if you want to do numerics. So this is the notorious sign problem. But in fact, in one special case, there is no sign problem. And this is the case that I'll be talking about today. So namely, you can rewrite the contribution of all diagrams of a fixed order as a product of two matrix determinants. So one matrix for spin up and one matrix for spin down. And each of these matrices captures already the sum weighted with the correct sign over all the different topologies or ways of connecting these spin up and spin down lines. So this rewriting is very convenient because we no longer need to take care of the different ways of connecting the lines. They're already in the determinant. And another great advantage is that if our system is symmetric in spin up and spin down, so if our chemical potentials are equal, then of course also these two matrices will be equal. So we have just the sum of squares. And this is always positive. So we can use the expansion of the partition function as a probability distribution for sampling. And so this, of course, only works in the case where we have equal numbers in the two components. Yes?
So the value of U at the utility form is independent of mu, is that right?
Yes, so we do a matching at actually zero temperature and zero chemical potential, and we calculate U from that.
So, and you are looking at the zero chemical potential limit?
No, so for the simulation, of course, you need to have finite chemical potential so that you produce some particles, you have a finite density or, in this case, filling factor. But just the matching of you do at zero temperature and chemical potential, so then you can sum all the diagrams and you can do a little calculation.
The question is whether U is larger than
Q. So U is about minus eight. So it's large. You cannot just truncate your expansion. So it's much. Yeah.
So that's why it's not.
Yeah. Yeah, so perturbation theory doesn't work. So also when I write down this expansion, please don't think that I'm doing perturbation theory because I'm not actually truncating the series. So we're going to sample the whole series and the algorithm will hopefully thermalize in the region where the weights are dominant. So actually this leads us to orders of several thousand. Which, of course, it depends on the filling factor and so on. But so you're sampling really high orders. Yes?
For me,
mu is very small.
Yes, so ideally, of course, you want to go to mu as small as possible because this is the continuum limit. In practice, the smaller mu, the harder it gets because, first of all, you need larger lattices so that you have any particles at all and your simulation slows down and so on. So it's always a trade-off between what you can do and what you really want to do. Yes.
I'm trying to understand the conclusion that this Haber, you say this Haber model, from any Haber model, just don't have sine problems.
It does. Just,
here you say, but here you just say, you know, because the product will depend on the state determinants, there is no sine problem.
If mu up equals mu down, you don't have a side problem
okay,
in
so
this case.
So that's the condition. So if
mu
up and mu down.
Yeah.
But do you also require to be, say, nearest neighbor Hopping? Or you don't require that?
Well, so the dispersion relation you use is up to you. In this case, we use the simplest one.
But even with longer range Hopping, you still do not have a sine problem. As long as the mu up equal to mu
yeah,
down.
So the Hopping, the kinetic term is all sort of, so you do an expansion in the interaction.
Yeah.
So your kinetic term just gives you your Green's function that you expand in.
Right. The only requirement is mu up equal to mu down.
Yeah, because the only, the Green's function, the only asymmetry between spin up and spin down is in the mu. All the rest is the same, so they have all the other parameters are the same.
Negative U
because so otherwise you'd be in trouble also. Yeah, so we are interested in the attractive case because in fact experimentally this is so you can do repulsion, but so when you realize these systems experimentally, actually repulsion is unstable. So you usually have the attractive case. This is.
You get problems, right? Because of this. You use positive.
Yeah, but use negative.
Yeah.
So yeah, if it was positive, yes, there would be problems. Yeah. But this is not what I'm interested in for this model. And so basically, what we achieve through this rewriting is that our system configuration is just the position in space and imaginary time of these different vertices and the number of the vertices. So all the ways of connecting the lines are already encoded in the determinant. So when I'm going to tell you something about the sampling, what I'm sampling are the positions of the vertices and in imaginary time. So imaginary time direction is continuous still.
Thinking about the Hopping, because you can do so. What you do is you somehow approximate the Laplacian, right? With using nearest neighbor Hopping, right? But you can also approximate the Laplacian with higher order terms.
Yeah.
Is that a problem or?
That's actually this is also a very interesting approach that might give you a better convergence towards the continuum limit.
But it doesn't mess up the fact that you have a sine problem. Because you're changing the Green function. Right?
Well, unless you change it in different ways for spin up and spin down, you cannot get any asymmetry in there. But which you wouldn't do, obviously. Yeah, so just a few words about how we actually how we measure the phase transition. We define an order parameter. So there are anomalous correlations present in the superfluid phase. And in our case, it makes sense to define a pair, so spin up and spin down annihilation and creation operator. And the correlator will tell us something about these anomalous correlations. So if we use some AG argument and look at the finite size scaling, then for our model, if we just, so we average our correlation function over the whole lattice and imaginary time, and if we rescale it appropriately with the universal exponent, then in principle, this integrated correlation function should become lattice size independent at the critical point. And so if we calculate and plot these different rescaled correlation functions for the different lattice sizes, then at the critical point, they should all cross. And so this is a very common method to find the phase transition. Of course, as you can already see in this plot, it doesn't exactly work out. And this is not only due to statistics, but it's also due to corrections due to relevant operators. So this is not entirely exact, and you get an additional correction term. So you have your universal scaling function on the one hand, and this correction term due to irrelevant operators on the other hand. There are some critical exponents that are very well known for the U1 universality class. And so here I've already expanded the scaling function up to the first order. There are, of course, many non-universal fit constants related to this expansion and here to the irrelevant operators. And then, of course, the most important fit constant is TC, which is what we are actually interested in. And so what many people do is they use the following approach. So the curve should all cross in a single point. Of course, they don't, but they do cross approximately in the same point. So we could somehow use the different crossing points between the curves to estimate TC. And you can write down a formula that gives you this difference between the crossings and TC, which is somewhat complicated, but all that you really need to see is that it only depends on the different on the two lattice sizes of your two curves and the critical exponents, up to this term that I colored in red, which also has this nasty non-universal constant in it. So what's kind of a straightforward idea is to say that we neglect this term, and then we just have a function only of the lattice sizes, and we can extract TC from it. However, in my particular case, it actually turned out that this constant becomes fairly large when you are in the dilute limit. So this didn't work. So what I did instead was just to fit the whole integrated correlator to this function. So this is a nonlinear fit, which is maybe a disadvantage. But on the other hand, you have many data points, and you can use all your data from the simulations in a single fit. And actually, you get really, really nice fit results that are very robust. So they don't depend so much on how many orders, for instance, you take into your expansion and so on. And from this, you can extract the critical temperature. So I think this is a very nice method that you should keep in mind if you're working with extracting TC from an order parameter, which actually is not less. So also the error bars here are actually smaller than the symbols. So you get really nice fits, and it's something definitely to keep in mind. So from this is how we get the critical temperature. And now I want to mention just very briefly how we actually do the sampling, so how the algorithm works. So this is due, again, to Borovsky, Prokofiev, Sisinov, and Troyer. And it works via a Monte Carlo Markov chain process. So we start with a certain vertex configuration, which, as I said, were just the positions of the vertices on the lattice in an imaginary time. We propose an update to a new configuration, which then gets either accepted or rejected, depending on the probabilities. And now the idea by those people, which is really powerful for many Monte Carlo algorithms, is to actually extend your configuration space. So you remember we defined these pair creation annihilation operators that the order parameter was built on. So the idea is to not just insert them as a Monte Carlo estimator just for measuring, but to actually promote them to be part of the configuration space. And this allows you to get the order parameter more easily, but it also sort of gives you a special kind of vertices through which you can perform updates. And they're called the worm vertices, and this method is called the worm algorithm. Now, of course, what you want is that your updates get accepted a lot. This increases your efficiency. So you would like your algorithm to propose configurations that are physically also dominant. And in this case, these configurations are multi-ladder diagrams. So you would like to propose updates that tend to prolong or shorten these clusters of vertices rather than just inserting new vertices at random. And the original set of updates worked as follows. So you have a set of updates that inserts and removes these two special 2.1 vertices into your configuration, one update that just shifts one of the worm vertices. And then your most important updates are the ones that actually change your diagram order. So the most straightforward thing to do would be obviously just to try to throw in a new vertex at random or to just remove one of the vertices at random. But this will most of the time not be accepted just because the system probably doesn't want to have a new vertex at some random position. And so the idea was to use a worm version of this update. So instead of inserting a completely new vertex, you take one of your worms and you replace it by your new vertex while moving the worm a little bit to the side. And so if you do it repeatedly, you will draw a kind of chain of vertices, or conversely, you can erase an existing chain of vertices. So this is the idea behind this update. However, again, all is not so simple, because what it turns out that the worm updates actually suffer from autocorrelations. And here's an example for a quantity called interaction energy, which is also proportional to the order of the diagrams. And you can see that the straightforward diagonal updates, so you can see it on this plot that just gives you this quantity over Monte Carlo time, that if you compare it to the worm updates where you have these really large kind of autocorrelated structures, this actually has much, much lower autocorrelations. And if you look at the error, here the error is blocked. So this block size gives you an idea of the autocorrelation time of your measurement. And you can see that the very basic diagonal updates, though they're not very efficient in terms of acceptance rate, the error actually saturates much faster and is in the end much smaller than with the worm updates. So because of this, I modified the worm update slightly. So I invented a new type of update, which is very closely based on the original worm setup. And it works as follows. So the reason for these autocorrelations, also I should say, is that you perform all your updates in terms of one worm. So what happens is, rather than sort of drawing a new vertex chain, then jumping to some other place and erasing and drawing a new vertex chain there, the update tends to just erase and create the same vertex over and over again. And so to avoid this, I just decided to take one of the regular four-point vertices and to promote them to a worm in each step, in each update. So in each update, you will select a different already existing regular vertex, and this will be your worm just for this given time step. And then again, it can create another vertex in its vicinity or erase a vertex in its vicinity. And also, of course, every now and then you have to try to throw in vertices just at random, just to make sure that you can also open up new vertex chains. And this actually works really well. So you can see a comparison at very low filling factor, which is where autocorrelations become a real problem, between sort of the straightforward diagonal setup and this alternative worm setup. And you can see that the error is smaller and autocorrelations are actually not a problem here. So this is sort of what I wanted to tell about the update structure and the diagrammatics. And as a final part of the method section, I'd like to tell you about the two limits that we need to take after we have done our sampling and we have obtained our data. So you remember we are on a finite and discrete lattice. So to get back our physical system, we need to first perform the thermodynamic limit to infinite lattice size, and then later also the continuum limit to zero lattice spacing. And so for the thermodynamic limit, we have to look at the filling factor, which is the dimensionless density, you could say, on the system, so the number of sort of particles that the algorithm simulates. And the intuition is that at small lattices, you get a higher filling factor due to self-interactions over the boundary. So we have periodic boundary conditions, so we'll get some self-interactions. And so you can plot your filling factor that you measured at different lattice sizes versus the inverse lattice size and extrapolate here towards zero. So you will get your thermodynamic limit in the end. And if you do it for the filling factor, this also gives you the relevant energy scale of the system, which is the Fermi energy, and which is just a function of the filling factor. And for the other quantities, you can derive analogous relations from here. Now, the continuum limit is a bit more tricky. Again, so the idea is that we want to go to zero density, and this will bring us to the continuum. So the physical scale is set by this equation. So the dimensional spilling factor is the density scaled with the lattice spacing cubed for dimensional reasons. And of course, continuum limit means zero lattice spacing. And in our model, this means zero filling factor. But also, this tells us that leading order lattice corrections, which are proportional to the lattice spacing B, will be proportional to the filling factor to the power of 1/3, just according to this relation. So you can perform your calculations for different chemical potentials corresponding to different filling factors, and you will get a series of points. And so if you're close enough to the continuum limit, then you can do a linear fit for your extrapolation. If you are too far away, then you get quadratic and higher order corrections, of course. And a nice cartoon, I think, to visualize it is to look at the dispersion relation. So I mentioned at the beginning that we're using the discrete cosine dispersion relation. That's the red solid line here. And it really well approximates the continuous parabolic dispersion relation near zero momentum. So as long as we have very small chemical potential, the energies will also be very small, and they will live in this region where the two dispersion relations agree really well with each other. So here we know that we will be in the linear regime for the extrapolation. But as we increase the chemical potential, and thus the density, then we will start populating energies where these two dispersion relations start to deviate. And so this is where we get higher order corrections and where we can no longer trust a linear extrapolation. So this was these were the methods that we used to get observables at the critical point. And this is just a little summary of our results at TC. If you're interested, you can also check out these references. So we calculated the critical temperature, chemical potential, energy density, and also a quantity called the contact density that I'll get to a little bit later. And we also generalized this model to the imbalance case. So we discussed a little bit about the sine problem and how it doesn't occur in the balance case. So we also studied the imbalance case for small imbalances, where you do have a sine problem, but you can use some tricks to still get some results. But I was not going to talk about it in this talk. So now, also just to compare with the literature and with experiment, so there has been a lot of work on TC and other properties at the critical point, and so this is also by no means a complete review, of course, of the literature. So here are some Monte Carlo, numerical results use this Binder crossings method to get TC from the order parameter that I mentioned at the beginning. And you can see that they're all significantly lower than our result here. And so this might be one of the reasons. So there's another result that uses nuclear matter calculation that also has, and that uses the full fit, just as we do, and that has a much higher value for TC. And there are also many experimental results that agree very well with each other and also with our value. And I plotted some of the results in this little comparison plot. So you see the numerical results as the red circles. Our results are to the left. This is the one using data from both balanced and imbalanced simulations, and this is just from the balanced simulation. These are the three numerical results that I just mentioned. And there are some other numerical calculations. There's also been a lot of analytical work, which is in blue, And the experimental results are here in green. And so you can see this black line and the gray arrow bar correspond to our best fit. And it matches really nicely, the experiment. So this is very encouraging. And so yeah, also, this line here is the BEC limit for comparison. So this is the exact result. So yeah, this was our work on TC. And in the last part of my talk, I'd like to tell you a little bit about how to generalize this method to temperatures above and below TC. So what's the challenge here? If you remember these continuum limit extrapolations, so we could do them because for each chemical potential value, we knew exactly when we're at the critical point by looking at the order parameter. So we could extrapolate along this critical line because we had the special quantity that told us when we were at the correct lattice TC. But this is no longer possible once you move away from TC. And it's actually not quite trivial how to fix the temperature scale to really extrapolate along the lines of constant physics. The other problem is that discretization errors get worse as you increase temperature. So you remember these plots of the dispersion relation. Of course, as you increase the temperature, you start populating higher energies, and this will bring you sooner into this regime where you have higher order corrections in your continuum extrapolation. So when you go to higher temperatures, you also have to compensate by going to lower filling factors, larger lattices, and so on. So that's numerically challenging. And so to circumvent the first and maybe alleviate a little bit the second problem, we decided in the end to use the inverse temperature times the chemical potential to fix the temperature scale. So this has the advantage that beta mu is just an input parameter in the simulation. So it has no error at all. And it's also not affected by discretization effects. And so we will be extrapolating along the curves of constant beta mu. Yeah, and so this actually already brings me to our result. I'm here for the chemical potential, normalized to the Fermi energy. On the horizontal axis, you have beta mu. And this gray bar is the critical value for beta mu. Our results are the red circles. And we compare them with the experimental results by the MIT experiment, which are in green. Also with the bold diagrammatic Monte Carlo calculation in blue and an analytical result with the black dashed line. And you can see, I think it's a really encouraging agreement. And especially what's very good is that we can actually do calculations at temperatures lower than TC. So this this side goes towards zero temperature because it's inverse temperature. And so you can see that there are quite many results that are below TC, which many other numerical methods cannot achieve. Now the same for the energy density. Also here, there's really nice agreement. And we can also sort of resolve there's some a little bit of a kink here around the critical beta mu. And so finally, we also did some calculations on the contact density. So the contact is a quantity that can be interpreted as a measure for local pair correlations, so for the local pair density, so for the density of the pairs in your system. And it also features prominently in several universal relations derived by TAN. Here we use a definition of the contact due to Vanna and Castan, which uses the interaction energy and the physical coupling constant. And we can recast it in terms of our lattice quantities quite easily. So I will be showing you results for the contact density, so divided by the volume in some dimensionless unit. And so here's the plot. Our results are again in red. And there's an experiment by the Gila group, which is in purple here, also for the homogeneous system, which matches quite nicely also our data. There's another experiment that was performed at very low temperature. So we can see here that the low temperature limit also works out quite nicely. And there's also, again, there is the bold diagrammatic Monte Carlo result. And another analytical result. And yeah, so I guess these are all the results that I wanted to show you. And yeah, so please, if you have any questions about the physics or the methods, then I'll be very happy to answer.
You mentioned your updates. You just mentioned the vertices, but how do you actually determine the diagrams themselves too in that?
Okay, so the trick is that you don't have to look at the individual diagrams in the sense that you don't have to keep track of how the lines are connected or how the vertices are connected, because this is all already encoded in this determinant. So. So this is one of the big advantages of writing it like this. So this determinant already has all combinations in it, just by the way how the determinant is defined. So it's the entries of this matrix are just the different free propagators. So between vertex 1 and 1, between vertex 2 and 2, and here maybe if you have a loop like this between vertex 1 and 2, 2 and 1, and so this is all already in here. So once you have the determinant, it already gives you the full contribution of all ways of connecting it.
So if the, I think if a spin, let me see, if spin up, spin down fermion have a, is there a hopping amplitude differ by a complex conjugate, it seems that also works. Is that right?
So you mean
they
if the...
As long as if there, you may spin up, spin down may have a complex hopping.
Do you mean that's a spin flip hopping or just different?
No spin flip.
No, just different.
So spin flip seems not allowed.
No, it's not allowed.
I see. Mm-hmm. But however, if a spin up, spin down, they differ by this complex conjugate. Maybe if you have a time reversal symmetry, whether this would be this method may also work.
Maybe I haven't.
And another thing is that how about this second neighbor interaction? That's also, can you include the second neighbor interaction? So the U is on site. We have a second neighbor interaction, whether you can still have a situation where there's no sign problem.
I don't know about that. So you don't, the form of the potential doesn't matter, which puts you in the advantageous situation that you can choose for your potential to be whatever you want, and then you can choose just the simplest form, which is just has on-site interaction. So if you think that it simplifies your model somehow to have maybe a more involved interaction, then you're also free to do it. But so this will not improve the accuracy of your model. But yeah, you could take for your potential anything. This is the advantage, because the range of the physical potential is unimportant. It's much, much smaller than the interparticle distance.
But the second neighbor interaction, I wonder whether the second neighbor interaction may spoil this sign.
I don't know. You will get some more complicated expansion for sure.
So you showed us these nice numbers would agree with other methods and experiments to some extent, but is there something qualitative that you learned from this algorithm? Or, like these curves, what do they mean really? Is there something more you can say about that?
Well, so I guess, I mean, the most striking feature is that the critical temperature is very high. And so now we have a reliable quantitative number for it. And when it comes...
The different methods give you a similar number
in the
field theory.
Yeah, sure. So the field theory is a very good estimate that gives you sort of the order of magnitude. I don't know, here I quite like this feature that something obviously happens at the critical point and you can resolve kind of how the curves, it's non-monotonous. And I guess... This is true. Yeah, this has something to do also with the fit.
So the dashed lines are
The dashed line is an analytical calculation. Yes, I guess we're just curious to know more about the system.
But and you measure, like, space time dependent quantities. Time-dependent.
We haven't measured. So yeah, I was hoping originally when I started the project to measure some transport coefficients, but this is very difficult with this method because basically your observables become really complicated, and the numerics just kills you. So this method is better for static quantities. But yeah, in principle, you could think of some Keldysh formalism, maybe not with a determinant Monte Carlo, that could also give you transport coefficients. And so then, of course, if you had higher temperatures, you have other great methods to study spin transport, like even with a molecular dynamics simulation, for instance.
Can you remind me again why you were taking the limit?
The continuum limit. So we're interested in the actual physical system, which is homogeneous and continuous. But we put our model on the lattice for numerical reasons. So the lattice is not physical. We do not want to model any kind of lattice systems, but a homogeneous system. And so this is why in the end, we have to get rid of the contribution of the lattice. So you can see it quite well in this plot. So the lattice suppresses your critical temperature. So if you take a lattice and a certain fixed value, of the chemical potential and the filling factor, your TC is much, much lower than your final result. So it's not reliable unless you really extrapolate to what's continuum if you want to compare to the physical system.
Very large lattice
size. It's a different issue, although they're somewhat related. But I mean, obviously, you cannot take infinite lattice size also. But so what you want to do is you want to your system to be very, very fine. And so, of course, you can achieve it by also taking really, really large system and then sort of having many, many particles there and have a good statistics, but you cannot do that. So you have two variables. One is the filling factor, the density of the particles in the system, and the other one is your total number of particles that you have in your system.
Real experimental setups. How big is mu in those systems?
Yes. So this you can measure it, right? So you get so these green points are measurements of mu in the experimental system of the physical mu. So there's you have to distinguish between the lattice chemical potential and the physical chemical potential. But so in an experiment, you have a homogeneous, you have a continuous system, which is in a trap. And you also have to use some tricks to get to either measure on a homogeneous part, on a fairly uniform part of the system, where the potential is very flat, or somehow do some extrapolation. But your system is continuous. And you can just measure all these quantities.
A little bit technical, but like suppose you start with the model in the continuum and you assign a chemical potential, like the continuum value of the chemical potential. Can you do the extrapolations for your temperature or for any quantity based on fixing that chemical potential as opposed to fixing the density?
Okay, I'm not 100% sure I understood your question. So, I mean, of course, you can use a model that's already continuous, that's not on the lattice. Like if you work in momentum space, for instance, that's not what I'm doing. But did you mean whether you could do these extrapolations in terms of the chemical potential rather than the filling factor on this axis?
So, but
some kind of matching that tells you what continuum system you'd correspond to?
But there's no matching, like the chemical potential is given
to you. So, like, mu of the continuum model, right? Which is a physical chemical potential.
Yeah, and this is what you calculate through an expansion exactly like this. So you would do the same, so this is an example for TC, but you do exactly the same for mu divided by the Fermi energy. So mu lattice, of course, is error-free and is an input parameter, but the Fermi energy is something that you calculate in a simulation. So you get exactly the same kind of expansion, an extrapolation, and then you get mu over EF at the critical point, or then at another temperature when you generalize to other temperatures. So this is also something that you obtain in the same way as you obtain TC here. But yeah, I guess in principle, you could do some extrapolation where you have mu in here also. That's it. Yeah.
Okay, so no further questions, let's take all the...
Thanks. And so I'm around until 5:30 today. So if anybody would like to discuss, I'm in 254. Please stop by and